Facebook, one of the few companies for whom a $5 billion fine may seem like a slap on the wrist. That's how much the world's largest social media company will pay to resolve a government probe into its privacy practices, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission said Wednesday. The FTC voted 3-2 along party lines to adopt the settlement, which requires court approval.
Weak sales in China and fallout from the tariff war slammed Caterpillar's earnings. The heavy equipment maker's quarterly profit slid and fell short of what analysts were expecting. Sales of construction equipment, the company's biggest revenue source, sank 22% in the Asia-Pacific region. Much of that stemmed from China, where economic growth has been slowing down. At the same time, Caterpillar's production expenses rose. That was due to higher costs related to tariffs and labor.
An Australian institution is changing hands. KKR says it is buying the maker of Tim Tam cookies. The US buyout firm will take snack maker Arnott's from current owner Campbell Soup. The deal is valued at $2.2 billion. Now it is the second sale of a big Australian food and drink brand in a week. Just days ago, AB InBev sold its operations there.
WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's July 25th. It's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. Lots going on in the world. You heard a big chunk of it in the opening montage this morning. Facebook is in the news. Lots of corporate earnings going on. We've got some news on Boeing this morning that we'll get to as well. On the program today, of course, it's Thought Leader Thursday, and Chuck Garcia will be here from Associated Bank. We'll have a conversation with Chuck about some banking developments, chief among them millennials still using banks, regular brick-and-mortar banks. And we'll have some of those numbers as we begin this morning with Chuck momentarily. A little bit later in the program, you probably heard this week that there is a potential change coming to the SNAP program. That's the food stamp program that could potentially impact nearly 3 million Americans. Elaine Waxman will be here. She's a senior fellow at the Urban Institute to talk about the economics and the impact of that potential move. That'll be about 5:38 this morning. Of course, we'll also keep you posted on the latest news, weather, sports, and traffic as we move through the 5 o'clock hour right here on 720 WGN. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The opening bell rings this morning after stocks closed out mixed yesterday as earnings reports continue to roll out. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ hit all-time highs as strong earnings reports from tech sector companies boosted the indices. At the closing bell, the Dow, though, dropped about 79 points. The S&P gained 14. The NASDAQ ended the day up about 70 points. This morning, mixed market futures market. Dow futures are up 41 points. NASDAQ futures are off nearly 18 points. S&P futures are up just fractionally this morning. Around the globe, markets in Europe are moving higher. In London, up nearly 0.25%. In Germany, up just fractionally. In France, up nearly 0.5%. A report this morning that says the European Central Bank may be about to cut a key interest rate. There could be a rate cut coming, so we'll follow that as well. That could impact the Europe markets, European markets moving forward. In Asia, the Nikkei is going to end the day in positive territory, up nearly 0.25%. In Tokyo, up nearly 47 points. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong up nearly 0.25%, up nearly 70. And in China, the Shanghai up nearly 0.5%, about 14 points. And oil is trading at $56.43 a barrel, which is up about 55 cents. You heard in the opening montage the settlement with Facebook. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are weighing in on the $5 billion settlement reached between the FTC and Facebook. The record-breaking fine comes after a report surfaced that the social media company was selling millions of Americans' user data to third-party companies. Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri criticized the deal for doing nothing to change Facebook's creepy surveillance of its users. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut says the deal is nothing more than chump change because it places no real restraints on future data use and no accountability for top executives. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle consider the fine to be just a slap on the wrist because Facebook recorded almost $56 billion in revenue last week. There's some more news about Boeing. Boeing CEO says the company will consider temporarily shutting down production of the 737 MAX if the plane's return is significantly delayed beyond the company's October forecast. Yesterday, Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg announced his hope that the grounded 737 MAX would be recertified by federal regulators by the fall, but he also acknowledged the company's nearly $3 billion loss in the second quarter of 2019 after those deadly crashes of its two planes. And the lawsuits continue to pile up against the Chicago-based plane maker as well, as it was announced yesterday that the wife of a U.S. Army captain killed in the Ethiopian Airlines flight 302 is suing Boeing. Her husband's remains still have not been returned to her. Let's begin this morning on Thought Leader Thursday. Chuck Garcia is here. He's the Executive Vice President and Director of Commercial Deposits and Treasury Management at Associated Bank. Chuck, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I saw an article that I wanted to hit you with first off this morning, and hit's probably a hard word. I shouldn't say that, but I thought the numbers were pretty stellar because I know we've had conversations about millennials and whether or not they're actually using banks. And Bank of America this week talked about their millennial customers, 16 million millennial customers with about $200 billion worth of deposits, investments, and loans with the bank. That seems like pretty good evidence that millennials are still using regular banks.
No doubt about it. Just not using them in the traditional ways that we grew up using them, but absolutely.
So what does this give you any sense of, you know, the technology obviously has transformed. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on that. I mean, looking at the bigger banks, this is something that Associated has been going through too, right?
Well, we're all going through it. Yeah, absolutely. Whether you're a community bank, whether you're a mid-sized bank like ourselves, or obviously the very large, I think the biggest thing it's reshaped is the branch, the utilization of the branch. And I mean, large banks ourselves, we still have branches. People use them, but it is such a sparing type of usage versus taking a photocopy or a picture of your check, deposit, it goes in, you never enter a bank. And so I think the biggest, visible is the transformation of what a branch is, what it's used for, and then obviously the numbers of branches are continuing to shrink, and I think that will just be the future we'll have.
Yeah, and the adapting to the technology, too, is something the banks have had to do, with the PayPals and the Venmos and the Squares. Talk to us a little bit about that transition or that adjusting. Like, for instance, what's been going on at Associated to deal with those?
Well, it really has first started with the consumer, but it's morphing its way into my business and the corporate side, too, of utilization of mobile, tablet, the security that's now available and the ability to secure a device versus what it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Is very strong. Nothing's immune to be hacked, obviously, but it's the security is so much stronger. So the usage and the desire of banks to push that out to first consumers, the demand was there. Banks met that demand, but also now it's moving into the corporate space as well. And we're seeing a really interesting, fun movement of that side.
You mentioned the commercial side there, the apps and the handheld devices, that sort of thing. Give us a sense of what that's like.
Well, today, I'd say the most common usage is if I'm a CFO of a firm and I'm out doing business outside the shop today or in the past, I would have to be somewhat tethered to my desk, maybe have a big string of key fobs that I would utilize. And fobs are still in use. But today, I could actually get the notification on my cell phone or tablet. Get an authentication over my phone or tablet, authenticate and approve that wire or divert a transaction, say, no, we didn't do that. So the information flow is immediate. It can be mobile. You don't have to be tethered to your desk as you used to in the past. Mm-hmm.
And this is a bigger question, too, and maybe we can dive into this a little bit. The treasury management system's changing on the corporate side. So while the banking folks are getting to enjoy some of this as well, companies are doing this as well. Talk to us a little bit about that.
As most things in the corporate space, it usually starts with the very large companies, the IBMs, the Microsofts, et cetera, that begin to utilize very sophisticated modeling, very sophisticated tools. So there are absolutely some really high-end sophisticated systems out there that have been in place for quite a while. And what that has done, too, it's reshaped the treasury function. It has shrunk those groups down substantially. So the number of people in large treasury groups where maybe they would have 20, 25 people, they're shrunk down 4, 5, 6 people now. And so the technology is very, very significant. And it's like everything else. It starts large and then begins to trickle itself into the middle market and into smaller companies. You know, QuickBooks is a great example. It's mm-hmm. effectively a treasury management solution for a very small company. But they're very sophisticated on the high end, but that's also moving into the middle market as well.
Do you, does Associated, for instance, I would go out and buy the QuickBooks for personal software.
Correct.
Do you, is that the way it works in the bank too, that you have software vendors that provide this, or do you, is this something you develop inside the bank?
We really have stayed away from developing solutions for our clients. Really, we're the feeder of information. So we feed information, we feed balance information, we give sophisticated transaction information. So we really put the information in the hands of our client. They then utilize whatever means, whether it's a spreadsheet or a sophisticated type of system, via the information we send. They make their decisions, and then they use our system typically to initiate whatever transactions they might have, be it an ACH, a wire transfer, what have you.
You mentioned the number of people working on these things has been cut. Talk to us a little bit more about some of the other savings that comes along with this, the economics of it.
Well, it's allowed banks too. A number of things. The move of banking into a cross-country type of environment really allowed, especially large companies and retailers in particular, to really shrink the number of accounts and relationships they had. So that goes back really 10 years past, where they really shrunk the number of relationships. Okay, you shrink the number of relationships, you don't have to reconcile, you don't have all the paperwork to go with it. And then in the midst of that, the technology has moved such that where somebody was doing sitting with a spreadsheet or maybe have the piece of paper in front of them, now that's all done by technology. So the technology has shrunk the need for people to actually do what were previously manual type of efforts.
Is the tech part of the technology artificial intelligence? Is that what's at play?
It's growing. That's growing substantially. Absolutely.
Does it? What are the mistakes like? And the security part of this? Is this just as solid as having people do it?
Well, any AI takes a little bit to learn, obviously. Mm-hmm. So there are going to be mistakes, and so during that period of time, people have to help the learning. But it's significant in terms of what it can do, and I think the future is really wide open there. I think that will continue to shrink those functions. Frankly, it'll have an impact on banks, too. So some of the things we do for clients today, perhaps they do it for themselves in the future.
How do we stack up against other countries? Has Europe been way far in front of us on this?
This particular area, not as much. You know, they were so far ahead in the usage of card, getting rid of checks, getting rid of cash. This particular area, I don't think they're quite as in front of us on this one.
Yeah. You mentioned security earlier. I want to talk a little bit about this. This past week, we saw the Equifax settlement.
Right.
I wanted to get, first of all, your reaction to the settlement and seeing that come to the end of that investigation. Do you think that was a fair settlement?
You know, I was actually surprised it wasn't larger, to be honest with you. When you look at the number of people that were impacted and really the longevity of what that impact can be, I thought it might be larger. I mean, it's still a big number. But, when I saw it, I didn't really dig deep into what was behind it, but I thought the number seemed a little smaller than I thought it might be.
Yeah, and I was surprised, too, that the amount of security coverage was only for 10 years, I believe. If you're one of the people that had your information taken, you really need to be on alert for how much longer into the future?
I think anything 5-7 years. The problem here is criminals are really patient.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got a wide array of things to go dabble in, so they're very patient. And they'll wait till the guard goes down on something and they'll try it. If the guard is up, they'll just move on to the next thing. But people have to be diligent all the way around. That information is really literally out there for almost forever.
Right. And your Social Security number, that's a lifetime.
That's a forever,
right.
Yes.
That's something that will never change. And I'm glad that I don't think I was hacked on that, but it seems like a lifetime of monitoring.
To me, it is. Well, you know, the other side, and we've talked about this on the show before, everything we do around the internet and passwords and anything around our money, we have to be diligent on all fronts.
There was a cybersecurity report issued recently about some of the trends to watch for going into 2020. And I was happy to see one of them is that cybersecurity budgets are going to be increasing. Do you find that that's the case in banking?
There is no doubt about it. Yeah. I'd say in banking, and then I see it very, very much on our customer side too. The recognition that this is a shared responsibility. It isn't just the banks any longer, but the clients have to secure their environments. And so I think on both fronts, absolutely in the banking sector, but I think on our client side too, people recognize that, you know, you can ruin a company really quickly. And as the CEOs, I think, have recognized appropriately, that's my company, my job, and they're giving it the right attention.
There had been some criticism that the way the game was being played was not necessarily defensive, not necessarily offensive. It was more defensive. Are companies and banks, is it more offensive now?
Trying to, yes. You know, I always hesitate with that of saying we're in front of it, because there's two schemes out there that we don't even know exist. But yes, we are trying to be way in front of it. And I think the sharing of information is much better today, too, amongst banks, amongst companies, of the latest, whatever the latest scheme is. I think we're pretty good, as well as working with the authorities, of sharing that information. I don't think we did so well in the past.
This report said that budgets for the first half of 2019 for cybersecurity increased 59%, and that trend was going to continue for the rest of the year into 2020. One of the other things, too, was that the amount of people being hired, they describe them as security talent, that these are the jobs that are in high demand in banking and elsewhere.
Very true. Very true. So it's one thing to put the systems in place if you don't have people that are able to diagnose those. So in our case, we have we'll have systems. Your transaction kicks out as abnormal. Okay. Somebody actually has to look at that, because it may be normal. It just looked like an anomalous transaction. It kicked out. So you have to have people that are actually knowledgeable to look at these, so we don't impact the customer in a negative way. It's a tough balancing act, but absolutely, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Do banks hire hackers to come in and play on the good side?
They do. Yeah. They do. I know of a number of organizations that absolutely do that.
That's interesting. And before we leave you this morning, Chuck, I wanted to talk to you about interest rates. I'm still one of the people trying to get my head around why we need to cut interest rates again, with the economy generally doing pretty well. We've seen some data points improve. What are your thoughts on this? What do you think we'll see from the Fed?
I'm in the same camp as you, I'll start with, and I'll stay out of the political realm, because I think part of it is driven politically in this particular time. Really, the data that you look at out there would not indicate that we should be cutting rates. I think the only thing that has any merit is some of the downturn in other parts of the world. But the United States is humming. I mean, you know, I can't think of an area that really is doing poorly. Housing starts were down a little bit. But that's a short-term phenomenon. I'm surprised at it as well.
Yeah, the trade situation with China, is the other unresolved issue, and that seems like it's going to be going on for a long time into the future.
Probably.
Do you think we'll see a half a point or a quarter point?
I'm in the quarter point, and I hope, frankly, that stays for the rest of the year. I think everybody's kind of building in a Q4 type of additional 25 basis points. I just don't see the data supporting that.
What are you hearing from CEOs and companies, business, some of your clients? I'm guessing it's maybe split evenly about being supportive and not.
Well, it is. If you're a borrower, it's like, wow, this is great. My rate just went down. If you're an investor, it's like, what do you mean you're cutting my rate?
Right.
So it's a tough time for banking. It's the margins are going to get squeezed really hard for the coming months.
Yeah, and I know you're probably redoing your budgets as well at the bank.
Just had a discussion before this.
Well, Chuck, how can people get a hold of you and have a one-on-one if they want?
If they want to call, it's 312-544-4346, or email is charles.garcia@associatedbank.com.
Always good chatting with you.
You as well. Thank you.
Chuck Garcia, Executive Vice President, Director of Commercial Deposits and Treasury Management at Associated Bank. It's our Thought Leader Conversation. We do it every Thursday here on The Opening Bell.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition of The Opening Bell. Nearly 3 million people could lose food stamp benefits under the Trump administration's proposal to tighten automatic eligibility requirements for the food stamp program. Elaine Waxman is a senior fellow in the Income and Benefits Policy Center at the Urban Institute, the Washington, D.C.-based think tank that carries out economic and social policy research. And Elaine is with us this morning to talk a little bit more about some of these developments. Elaine, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
If you read the stories about this, there's some notion that the government thinks that this loophole that they want to close in the food stamp program will somehow weed out people who are taking advantage of the program or somehow getting a free ride in one way or another. That's not really accurate, is it?
No, unfortunately, it's not. And the government's own data shows us that the people who are most likely to be affected are families with some earnings, so the working poor, and also disproportionately families with kids. So, you know, these are exactly the kinds of households that the program was designed to support. And so it seems to be working against a little bit the overall goals of the SNAP program.
Talk to us a little bit about the nuts and bolts of this. I know this proposal, this rule will involve something called the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. Talk to us about that.
Sure. So the TANF program that you referenced is a block grant that a lot of states use to fund a variety of programs for low-income families. And the way that this has been connected to SNAP or food stamps is that if you were eligible for one of those programs, you could receive eligibility for consideration for SNAP. And so this will considerably narrow the programs that allow you to have that automatic link. And we worry about that because, again, it tends to help us reach exactly those kind of families that we're concerned about. So, for example, in Illinois, the option that states have to take this particular eligibility rule is that families who earn just a little bit above the federal government level, the ceiling for SNAP, can still qualify even if they have significant expenses. And that's a great feature because it allows families who are hovering right around that eligibility ceiling to not be penalized if, say, they get a small raise. What happens sometimes when that occurs with families is maybe they get a 50 cent bump, but they actually do worse off when they lose their SNAP benefits. So that's the kind of thing we want to avoid. We want to support families who are working towards self-sufficiency.
Yeah, and as I look at some of the numbers here, let's use that 50 cent pay raise bump that you talked about. There will be a dramatic loss in benefits, up to $31 a month, if I'm reading some of these numbers correctly. So just a small raise hourly would potentially push a family further into food insecurity.
Right. And so then you put families in a difficult situation. If you accept that raise, you're actually going to have less money available for your food budget. And that's not the kind of situation we want families to be in.
There's also the notion that if you have a little bit of savings or some asset of some sort, too, that you would become unqualified. The notion that people who are on these programs might be saving a lot of money seems sort of silly. As we know, most Americans barely have $400. A good number of Americans barely have $400 to cover an emergency. So talk to us about if they lose benefits in one area, how is that going to affect their finances in another?
Yeah, that's another important feature of this rule is it's allowed states to relax asset tests in SNAP. And again, that supports a goal that I think we would all agree with, which is that we want families to have some kind of buffer so that if they experience an emergency room visit or a car repair or some other unexpected expense, they can handle that without going into debt or, you know, incurring significant hardship. So we appreciate that that is a feature that this rule offers. What we know is that families who can have a little bit of those savings on hand do much better. We also know that states that have taken this particular option that the administration is trying to narrow, that families are more likely to have a bank account in those states, which tells us that it is helping people sort of move forward in terms of their financial stability. And as you pointed out, this is not an unusual problem for lots of Americans, not just those who qualify for SNAP. It's really tough for people to have those savings on hand.
Yeah, and I'm scratching my head because if the idea is you want to help people climb out of poverty, this seems like it's doing this rule change would seem like it would do the opposite of that.
I think a lot of states would agree with you. You know, there are 39 states plus D.C. that have taken this option. And what that tells us is that there are red states and blue states and urban and rural areas. And they've all found value in this particular rule flexibility. And so it tells us that, in fact, it's helped states respond to what they see in their communities. And by restricting this, the government is actually taking that flexibility away. We also know that there are, you know, there are preventive measures in place to keep people who really aren't deserving from taking advantage. So even if you come in with slightly higher income, you still have to demonstrate that your monthly income is low enough to receive the SNAP benefit.
The Trump administration, the agriculture secretary specifically, in announcing this rule earlier this week, said talked about misuse of what he called this loophole, said that this would save, there'd be a net savings of about $9.5 billion over 5 years. Given the size of the food stamp program, is that a significant number? And is there misuse inside of this program?
So there's very little evidence of abuse in the program. And what we know from their own data is that folks who come into SNAP through this particular rule flexibility overwhelmingly qualify just based on their income. Is it significant savings? You know, that's something that they've emphasized, but I would ask us to think about whether we really save money. So we know that food insecure families are more likely to have children who are hospitalized or in poor health. We know food insecure seniors are more likely to have chronic health conditions. So typically savings in one area is going to show up as an expense in another. So it's very difficult to be confident that, in fact, we save money in the long run.
And this might also have ripple effects on other important populations. One is this could remove kids from the free lunch at school program.
Yeah, this is a feature that people don't know a lot about, but we have a way of using this particular rule flexibility to automatically certify kids for free and reduced price lunch. It may mean that a lot of kids are still eligible for the reduced price feature, but, you know, that extra money every day going to expenses is a hardship for families. And we then put families in the situation of trading off between, you know, food and school supplies or food and medicine or food and utilities. So, you know, that program is really a central buffer for lots of families with kids, and it just makes it a little bit harder for people to access it.
Elaine, you actually testified about this to the House recently and have before. This seems to be a complete runaround of what Congress specifically decided about the SNAP program. They decided in the Farm Bill that recently passed, I believe, to not make any of these cuts. So this is appears to be the president trying to do an end run around what Congress actually wanted.
Well, that's an interesting point, yes, because this type of provision was included in the considerations last year. The Farm Bill is the legislative vehicle that is used to reauthorize the SNAP program. And so there was a very specific vote on this feature, and it was defeated. So, yes, I do think the administration is attempting to accomplish that. And again, because it's widely used across the United States, I'm not sure that they've thought through exactly how it will be received.
What do you think will be the end result here? Do you think the rule will end up taking effect, or do you think it'll be challenged?
Well, I think that's a good question. The way this process works is once the rule is proposed, we have a 60-day comment period. So that means individual citizens or advocacy groups or state or local governments can all submit comments, and the federal government is required to review those and prepare an analysis of them. In some cases, that can result in them modifying their final rule. It can also delay the process somewhat. So, you know, it might be several months before we know the outcome. But, you know, I think it's very possible that some version of this will go forward and that as a result, you know, there will be people who will lose benefits and we'll all lose.
Elaine, we appreciate you being on with us this morning and sharing your expertise on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elaine Waxman, Senior Fellow in the Income and Benefits Policy Center at the Urban Institute, with us this morning. You can find more online at urban.org.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a positive open, at least a mixed open on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures are up 49 points. NASDAQ futures are down by about 29 points. S&P futures are off fractionally this morning. Now agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. As we look at yesterday's market activity, livestock futures were mixed yesterday. A lack of buying interest and light cash trade prompting dealers to sell their nearby live cattle contracts and buy the deferred cattle months. Meanwhile, traders are looking ahead to next week when top U.S. and Chinese negotiators will meet face-to-face for the first time since President Trump and President Xi Jinping agreed to revive talks to end their trade war. Checking some of the other news stories in agriculture yesterday, well, let's look at today. Secretary of Agriculture Perdue has a busy day, having breakfast this morning with national FFA state and national officers. And then later today, he'll go to the Delaware County Fair and will actually attend the livestock auction tonight. It'll be interesting to see if and what he might buy. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Thursday, July the 25th. It's going to be a busy day, not only for earnings, but also for economic reports today. Durable goods orders start things off. Wholesale inventories and the weekly report on first-time unemployment claims are all out today. Durable goods orders for June are seen rising 0.7% after falling 1.3% in May. Analysts are forecasting a gain of 0.4% in wholesale inventories. Economists expect to see first-time claims for jobless benefits come in at 219,000, 3,000 more than last week's report. On the earnings calendar today, 3M, American Airlines, Southwest Airlines, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, Comcast, Hershey, Nokia, Amazon, Alphabet, Intel, Mattel, and Starbucks all reporting quarterly earnings today, either before or after the bell on Wall Street.